Turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 1. Usually for Mother's Day, we take the opportunity to exhort the men in our congregation on being a godly man in the home. But this morning, we're going to do something a little different. It is our usual plan that we don't want the mothers to go out feeling like they don't measure up. So we speak to the men, but today we're going to speak to you ladies, and again, we're not wanting you to walk out feeling like you don't measure up. This is really a message for all of us on godly living, but it comes from a woman named Hannah. Hannah is the epitome of a godly mother. She was a woman of faith, she was a woman of faithfulness, and she was a woman of family. That's our outline this morning. She was a woman of faith. She prayed. She was a woman of faithfulness. She kept her word to the Lord, and she was a woman of family. She made her family her priority. And God richly blessed her because of it and used her. And really, if you know the story, you know she was quite a remarkable woman. And she came on the scene at a time when remarkable people, at least in the godly sense of the term, were few and far between. You see, she lived in the time of the judges. This was that time in Israel's history when there was no king and everyone did right in their own eyes. It was a time of great moral and spiritual declension. There were no moral absolutes. There were no spiritual absolutes governing society. Everyone did as they saw fit. And as time went on, this spiritual narcissism just ran rampant. And in 300 years or so of the time of the judges, it just got worse and worse and worse as time went on. So much so that by the end of the period, the nation of Israel looked just like the Canaanite nations before them. They were committing the same kinds of atrocities and even worse. In fact, in the Hebrew Bible, 1 and 2 Samuel are one book, and they follow the book of Judges. The book of Ruth is placed somewhere else in the Hebrew canon. And if you look at the two books, Judges and 1 and 2 Samuel, you'll see that the thematic links between these two books are worth noting. By the end of the book of Judges, the Levitical priesthood is found spiritually inept. There was sexual misconduct at Shiloh. That was the center of Yahweh worship, and the Levites were engaging in tragic military campaigns. In other words, the book of Judges ends with the Levitical priesthood leading God's people into sin. And when you begin the book of 1 Samuel, you'll see that these kinds of sordid activities are evident in the sons of Eli, the priest. This is the same time. And in this dark spiritual time, Hannah and her husband are really the only two bright spots worth noting. And through them, God would produce Israel's final judge and first prophet in the prophetic order. This would be their legacy in their son Samuel. In fact, the last judge that we meet in the book of Judges was a man named Samson. He was a self-indulgent judge whose carnality compromised his mission. What Samson couldn't complete, Samuel did complete. He delivered Israel from the oppression of the Philistines and made a way for a king in Israel. Again, the thematic links between Samson and Samuel are not coincidental. Samuel is the man that Samson should have been. And he was more. But we get ahead of ourselves. We're not here to talk about Samuel. We're here to talk about his mother, Hannah. But he is who he is because of who she was. All right, and she takes center stage in these first two chapters of 1 Samuel. So it's here that we see the character of a godly mother. And the first characteristic we see is that Hannah was a woman of faith. Notice as we read in verses 1 through 8. And this idea here of Hannah as a woman of faith is developed in kind of two parts, but the first part here is against the backdrop of a problem. This is Hannah's problem. There was a certain man from Ramathaim Zophim from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man would go up from the city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests to the Lord there. And when the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. And it happened year after year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her. So she wept and would not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? This introduces us to Hannah's problem. The opening verses introduce us to a man named Elkanah. He lived in the town of Ramathaim Zophim. In verse 19, the name of the town is shortened to Ramah. Ramathaim means twin heights. It was located in the hill country of Ephraim, 5 miles north of Jerusalem. Verse 1 records his family tree and calls him an Ephraimite. Actually, he was an Ephraimite in residence only. It would be like saying you're an Oregonian because you live here. 1 Chronicles chapter 6, we find that Elkanah was a descendant of Levi. Remember that the Levites were the priestly class of Israel. And when the tribes were apportioned their land, the Levites were dispersed so that they could live among the people. The Levites in Ephraim lived in the hill country. In verse 2, we're told that Elkanah had two wives. Never a good recipe for harmony in the home. The writer tells us that the name of the one was Hannah and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This introduces us to the heart of the problem here. God's ideal for the family was always one man and one woman for life, Genesis chapter 2. And by recording the fact here that Elkanah had two wives isn't necessarily condoning nor condemning the practice. It's simply recording the facts. In ancient Near Eastern culture, it was a common practice for a man to take a second wife if the first wife couldn't produce him any children. It was a way to perpetuate the family name. This was the custom behind Sarah's offering to Abram Hagar. The fact that Hannah is mentioned first here implies that she was the first wife. In fact, Hannah was his heartthrob. She was his dreamboat, his buttercup, right? His beloved Shulamite. He loved her immensely. She was the apple of his eye, but she couldn't produce any children for him. So he took a second wife, Peninnah. Reading ahead, we get the picture that she was a second-class citizen in the family. It seems her only value to Elkanah was in the fact that she could produce children. How would you like that hanging over your head? The only reason why she was in the family was because Hannah couldn't give Elkanah any children. But in this she excelled. In fact, she was exceedingly valuable because she multiplied like a rabbit. And this was making a serious problem for Hannah. Now, we should just say that the problem of barrenness was a serious issue for an ancient Israelite. And it carried a certain stigma with it. And I don't think that it should be viewed in the same way today. But because America has been built on Judeo-Christian values or that kind of a framework, some of the Old Testament stigma unnecessarily lives on. In the Old Testament, fertility was both a creation ordinance and a blessing of God. And thus, not to have children was interpreted as a curse. In fact, Deuteronomy 28 says that fertility is a promised blessing for obedience, and infertility is a punishment for disobedience. And so for the childless Israelite, it was a matter of great reproach and humiliation. So much so that Rachel, Jacob's wife, could wish herself dead unless she had a child. To an ancient Israelite, it was often misinterpreted as a sign of God's disfavor. Now again, aside from the natural disappointment of those of motherly desires, I don't think we ought to import the Old Testament view of childlessness for today. Even in the context of this chapter, we see that sometimes God has other plans and purposes behind infertility. But for the ancient Israelite, it was considered a way to continue the family and consequently a sign of God's blessing. And of course, when there wasn't children, that was seen as a curse. But for Hannah, God's plan had caused her deep distress because her significant other-in-law, Peninnah, made her feel the brunt of it. Notice verse 3. Now this man would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests to the Lord there. And when the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah. But the Lord had closed her womb. According to Deuteronomy, once the people were established in the land, every family was to make the trek to the central location to worship Yahweh. We see this in Deuteronomy chapter 12. This is what Elkanah was doing. He was taking his family to Shiloh to worship the Lord of hosts. And this says something about his character. He was a godly man. He was a religious man. He might have been influenced by his culture in taking two wives, but it wasn't the result of personal rebellion. It was just the degradation of the times. At a time when personal religion was at an all-time low, Elkanah was a godly man leading his family in worship. And so he'd take them to Shiloh. Shiloh was 15 to 20 miles east of Ramah. Since the division of the land in Joshua chapter 18, it became a home for the tent of meeting and hence for the Ark of God. For the last 300 or so years, the Ark had remained at Shiloh. Note the title, Lord of Hosts. Interesting title. We'll say more about it next week. I think next week we'll look at Hannah's praise in chapter 2. But this is the first occurrence of this title in the Old Testament. It's a term frequently used by later prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Zechariah and Malachi, over 200 combined uses in those books alone. It's a title frequently found in the Samuels and the Kings and the Chronicles. Used with the divine name Yahweh, it was primarily a military, a title referring to Yahweh as the one in control of heaven's angelic armies, 1 Kings 22, or of Israel's armies, 1 Samuel 17. The title speaks of infinite resources and the power that belong to God. It stresses His sovereignty, His omnipotence. It looks at God as the universal sovereign in control. Now keep that in mind for just a minute. The main point here is simply that this is the one whom Elkanah and his family came to worship regularly in Shiloh. Notice too that we're introduced to the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. They were serving at the tabernacle at this time. They're mentioned here because they form a contrast with Samuel in chapter 2. Now notice that when Elkanah's turn to sacrifice, verse 4, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he would give a double portion because he loved Hannah. But the Lord had closed her womb. The sacrifice that is mentioned here that is shared by the giver was the peace offering. It celebrated the worshiper's fellowship, restored fellowship with God. The worshiper would provide the meat and then receive some back to be enjoyed by the family. The meal would be proportionate to the size of the family. So marking the contrast between Penina and Hannah, the text says, to Penina, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. That description highlights her fertile worth. He gave her a considerable portion to divvy out to the kids. Meat was a rarity in Israel's diet. So this was a celebratory treat here. But note to Hannah, it says Elkanah gave a double portion. And note why. Because he loved her. But the Lord had closed her womb. Now all these details here are given to help us understand the problem going on. All the sons and daughters of Penina was the problem for Hannah because the Lord had closed her womb. But for Penina, the problem was different. She was unloved. She already felt like a second-class citizen in the family. She knew that her only value to Elkanah was the fact that she bore his children. Without that ability, she wouldn't be in the family. And to make matters worse, she knew that Elkanah loved Hannah more. Aside from the daily expression of it in the home, every time she came to the place of worship, Elkanah gave her a very vivid picture of it when he apportioned out the food. I can only imagine how that got to Penina. Every time you find favoritism in the Bible, every time it leads to serious trouble. Whether it be Isaac favoring Esau or Rebekah favoring Jacob or Jacob favoring Rachel over Leah or Jacob favoring Joseph over his brothers, it always leads to pain and problems. And such was the case here. And in response to the love and the favoritism shown by Elkanah to Hannah, Penina took the opportunity to flaunt her productivity. Verse 6, her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb, and it happened year after year. She went up to the house of the Lord. She would provoke her, so she wept and would not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat and why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? The word rival there means enemy or adversary. The time of family worship had become a battleground, and Penina was the aggressor. She was flaunting her fertility. And see, she could do this because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb. Now the point is made twice in those verses, and it tells us that Hannah's barrenness wasn't a result of God's displeasure or her sin. It was a result of providence. But neither Penina nor the family was privy to that. All she knew was that Hannah couldn't have kids, and so every year at this specific time, she took the opportunity to rub Hannah's nose in it. She would provoke her bitterly to irritate her. Those are strong words. Repeated verbal action, right? She just wouldn't let up. Now, from my earliest years of childhood, I can always remember having cats in the house. At various points, we would have more than one cat, and whenever we would get a kitten, we'd have to teach the kitten how to use the litter box. But as cats grow older, every so often one of them would pee on the floor or on the carpet, and we would take the cat that peed on the floor, and we'd rub their nose in it in the ground to teach them not to do it again. This is what Penina would do to Hannah every time they came to worship. She would always seize the moment of celebration before the Lord to point out to Hannah that Hannah was childless, and the assumption being that she was cursed of God. And Penina did it just to irritate Hannah, just to stir her up on the inside. You ever known people like that? They have nothing of value to offer. They just want to irritate you. They just want to provoke you to frustration or to anger or to tears. The word irritate means cause to thunder. It's a very picturesque word. She just wanted Hannah to just shake inside. And she's trying to turn over Hannah's spirit, a spirit that was depressed, that was unhappy, that was hopeless, that was helpless, that was angry and confused and dejected. I mean, the fact that Hannah was barren was bad enough. Penina's goal was just to make it worse. Dale Ralph Davis paints a picture of the scene at the worship table. It goes like this. This is Penina speaking with her child, one of her kids. Penina says, "Now, do all you children have your food? Dear me, there are so many of you, it's hard to keep track." And one of her kids says, "Mommy, Miss Hannah doesn't have any children." Penina says, "What did you say, dear?" "I said, Miss Hannah doesn't have any children." Penina says, "Miss Hannah, oh yes, that's right, she doesn't have any children." "Does she want children?" "Oh yes, she wants children very much. Wouldn't you say so, Hannah? Don't you wish you had children too?" "Doesn't Daddy want Miss Hannah to have children?" "Oh, certainly he does, but Miss Hannah keeps disappointing him. She just can't have kids." "Why not?" "Why, because God won't let her." "Does God not like Miss Hannah?" "Well, I don't know. What do you think?" "Oh, by the way, Hannah, did I tell you that I'm pregnant again? Do you think you'll be pregnant this year, Hannah?" See, this was Penina just seizing the moment to rub her nose in it. And verse 7 adds, "And it happened year after year, as often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her. So she wept bitterly and would not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, 'Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat and why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?'" It was the same humiliating experience year after year. And finally, it got so bad that Hannah completely lost her appetite. She was reduced to tears and she couldn't deal with it any longer. And Elkanah, well, he tried the best he could to comfort her. Right? He tried to affirm his love for her. He tried to help her see that his care for her was better than if she had 10 sons. But she was distraught, discouraged, and humiliated, and confused. The phrase "heart sad" there is rendered by the NIV as "downhearted." It means bad-hearted in Deuteronomy 15. Again, it's a strong word. It can refer to resentment or anger or spite. In context, it probably refers to discouragement and depression. Someone once described depression as frozen anger. You see, she was obsessed with her barrenness. It was a major source of personal tension in her life. And because she had a husband who loved her and doted on her and showered her with favor to compensate, she had an overly fertile, unloved other-in-law who just loved to rub her nose in it and make her look bad. And so she was depressed. God hadn't allowed her to have any children. So caught up in herself was Hannah that as time went on, all she could do was cry. She couldn't eat, couldn't appreciate the love and kindness of Elkanah. She was miserable because Penina made it tenfold worse. This is Hannah's problem. But thankfully, Hannah was a godly woman. And she demonstrates it in a godly response. Against the backdrop of that problem, verses 9 to 18 show us Hannah's prayer. This is where we see her godly characteristic of faith shine. When Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh, now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the temple, and she, greatly distressed, praying to the Lord, and wept bitterly. And she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy maidservant and remember me, and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord in all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. Now it came about as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli was watching her mouth. As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard, so Eli thought she was drunk. Then Eli said to her, How long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you. But Hannah answered and said, No, my Lord. I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation. And then Eli said to her, Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him. And she said, Let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went away and ate, and her face was no longer sad. That she was depressed and discouraged is obvious. Who wouldn't be? But she took it to the Lord in prayer. She took the issues of her heart to the throne of grace, and she found mercy in her time of need. These verses are an extended commentary on her prayer. We see it first from the perspective of Hannah and then from the perspective of Eli. Both perspectives show us the intensity of her prayer and hence her faith. I don't know about you, but I venture to say that most of us don't pray like Hannah. Like someone who is lost in the art of fervent prayer. Most of us, you know, take the issues of life, even the heart-rending issues like Hannah's, and we spend more time complaining with our friends or posting it on Facebook or turning it over in our minds or distracting ourselves than pouring our hearts out to the Lord. This wasn't a 5-minute, you know, Lord, I need help now prayer. This wasn't a 10-minute, Lord, please take this away prayer. This was a woman who was broken before the Lord. She was downcast. She was discouraged. She was despondent. She was disillusioned by her circumstances. And she's pouring out her complaint and pleading for God to intervene. Notice that after the worship meal, in verse 9, it says, Hannah arose and went to the temple door. Verse 10, and she greatly distressed, praying to the Lord and wept bitterly. NIV says, in bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. Again, we're reminded of Hannah's emotional state. She was greatly distressed. This is a favorite term of Job. It describes deep disappointment, mental anguish and embitterment. In 1 Samuel 22, it refers to someone who is discontent. Hannah doesn't put on any kind of facade at all when she comes before the Lord. She comes with honest, discouraged, discontented heart, and she just pours it out before the Lord. Verbal action here is repetitive action. It's just going on and on and on. In England, they tell you to have a stiff upper lip, no emotion, right? Miss Stoic, you don't cry, you suck it up, you tough it out, right? Not Hannah. She wept and prayed. Listen to her, verse 11. She made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look upon the affliction of thy maidservant and remember me and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. Beloved, that is a pretty impressive prayer, i.e., an expression of her faith. Notice a couple things here. Notice her address. O Lord of hosts. That's that grandiose term, title of verse 3. That title that emphasizes God's sovereignty and omnipotence. This is the title that depicts the Creator as the commander-in-chief leading the armies of heaven and earth. It speaks of power and resources that are at His disposal. And the first time it's used by someone, it's found on the lips of a woman in deep distress. And she's asking Him to do something for her. Bergen said her pain made her a theologian. You hear what we're saying here? She implicitly realized that the Lord of hosts was not just limited to the battlefield, but that He was someone intimately concerned with her and her situation. And so that if He chose to do so, He could exercise His unlimited power and change her condition. 18 times in this chapter and the next, she addresses God by His covenant name, Yahweh. That's pretty impressive. It shows relationship. It shows knowledge of God. It shows her faith. She's asking God Almighty to do something for her. Notice also the posture of her prayer. She refers to herself as thy maidservant. She says it 3 times. It's the picture of humility. The term is used of a household slave, right? She isn't demanding her request. She doesn't approach Him as though she deserves to be answered, and yet she humbly asks just the same. Because she knows that He has the power to do it if He wills to. Thirdly, notice the essence of her prayer. Remember me in my affliction and give me a son. This is a call for deliverance, a call for personal help. It's a call to act on her behalf and give her a son. And in that sense, it is incredibly selfish. But not so much to be out of line with the purposes of God. Finally, notice her request is stated in the form of a vow. If thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy maidservant and remember me and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. The vow is that if God gave her the son she desired, she would give him back for lifelong service. Reference to no razor there indicates the service she has in mind is Nazarite service found in number 6. Her promise was to dedicate him to lifelong Nazarite service in the Levitical sphere. Listen to Evans' assessment of this. She says, Hannah's prayer is not meant to be a bribe to God. Give me a son and I promise I'll give him back. Hannah's longing for a son may have been inherently selfish, but it was not exclusively so. Rather, Hannah is communicating her personal longing for a son and her genuine desire to dedicate to the Lord all that He gives her, including her son. This is pretty impressive. Her lack of children was the reason for her great distress, albeit the badgering of Penina. And yet the one thing that she wanted more than anything else in the world, the very thing that she's asking for, is the very thing that she's offering back to God, if He'll grant it. We ask for things all the time, don't we? Usually for ourselves. I'm sure Hannah had been doing that year after year. James says, when you ask and you do not receive, you because you ask with wrong motives that you may spend it on your pleasures. But this time there is something different. Hannah was asking with a different motive. I'll give the boy to you, Lord. I'll put him in your service. I'll dedicate him to your glory and not my own. We say, Lord, I want a better relationship with my spouse. I want a better job. I want a better boyfriend or a better girlfriend. Right, right. Lord, I want. Hannah vows, Lord, if you answer my request, I'll give the answer back to you. That's quite a vow. Lord, give me the one thing I want and I'll give it back to you forever. Now listen carefully here. By highlighting this feature of Hannah's prayer, we're not suggesting that we make vows to the Lord. That can be pretty stupid. In fact, we're warned against it, Matthew chapter 5. But Hannah definitely had the right perspective concerning her request. She was approaching the King of creation. Right? And she was asking him to take notice of her and promising that if he did, she would dedicate his answer to his glory. That was the expression of her faith. And she was earnest in this. She truly meant this. And so looking at the fervency of her faith, from Eli's perspective, we see in verses 12 through 18, it says this. Now it came about as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli was watching her mouth. As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. And then Eli said to her, how long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you. But Hannah answered and said, no, my Lord, I am oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation. And Eli answered and said to her, go in peace. May the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked from him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. And so the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. Custom of the day was to pray audibly. But because of her earnestness, because of her fervent spirit, her lips were moving, but nothing was coming out. Eli thought she was drunk. Obviously, it was a sign of the times. Probably many people did that. This emphasizes Hannah's intensity. David said, Psalm 142, verse 2, I pour out my complaint before the Lord. This is Hannah. She's troubled in spirit. She has a complaint, and she's making sure that the Lord hears her. Right? Not only did she direct her troubles to the Lord, she also consecrated her heart through the fervency of her prayer. In other words, Hannah was going to stay there until the Lord answered her prayer. Reminds me of Jacob wrestling with God, right? Not letting him go until he gets the blessing. The phrase, I poured out my soul to the Lord, was a Hebrew idiom for praying earnestly. It's used a number of times in the Psalms. And so as she did this, her anguish was turned to peace. Her burden was lifted. Eli said, verse 17, go in peace and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him. So trusting in the intercessory function of the priest, she went back to the table and got something to eat. Her countenance changed. She was no longer downcast. Means that within her soul, her stigma was removed. She poured out her heart to the Lord and she left it with him. Right, and the peace of God governed her heart. And verse 19, the Lord of hosts granted her request. Beloved, Hannah was a woman of faith. She prayed, she believed in the Lord of hosts that he would answer the desperate prayers of a humble servant for his own glory. And she was content to trust him with the outcome. What an impression that must have made on her son Samuel, who would later be known as a prophet of prayer. Chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 15. In fact, one of his most famous lines is, "As for me, far be it from me that I should what? That I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you." Mothers, pray for your families. You have direct access to the Lord of hosts. I mean, is anything too difficult for the Lord of hosts? So beg him. Badger him. Right? Pour out your heart to answer you for his own name's sake. This is what it means by going boldly to the throne of grace. This was the expression of Hannah's faith. And this brings us to a second godly characteristic of Hannah, her faithfulness. She kept her vow to the Lord. But she was true to her word because she was true to her God. We see this in verses 19 through 28. This is Hannah's faithfulness. Then they arose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord and returned again to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah had relations with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And it came about in due time after Hannah had conceived that she gave birth to a son and she named him Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked him of the Lord." Then the man Elkanah went up with all his household to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, "I will not go up until the child is weaned, and I will bring him and that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever." And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what seems best to you. Remain until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord confirm his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. Now when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with a 3-year-old bull and one ephah of flour and a jug of wine and brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh, although the child was young. And then they slaughtered the bull and brought the boy to Eli. And she said, "Oh, my Lord, as your servant lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. For this boy I prayed. And the Lord has given me my petition, which I have asked of him. So I have also dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. Verses 19 and 20 record the Lord's answer to Hannah's prayer. The phrase, "and the Lord remembered," here is a wonderful phrase. On the one hand, it specifically recalls her request of the middle of verse 11. Right, the Lord of hosts acted on her behalf, on behalf of this rural housewife in the hill country of Ephraim. I mean, God is good here. Not only does he control the affairs of history, but he intervenes on behalf of his bondservants. And on the other hand, the phrase is used in some pretty significant soteriological contexts. Noah on the ark. Genesis chapter 8 verse 1 says, "But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And God caused a wind to pass over the earth and the water subsided." Israel in Egypt, Exodus chapter 2 verse 24 says, "So God heard the groanings, Israel's groanings, and remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them." When the Lord is the subject of this verb remembered, it indicates that he is about to act in some pretty significant salvific way. In this case, the provision of a son that would one day free his people from Philistine oppression and that would also one day transition the leadership of God's people into the hands of a king. says, "And it came about in due time after Hannah conceived that she gave birth to a son. And she named him Samuel, saying, 'Because I have asked him of the Lord.'" God gave her the son that she wanted. The name Samuel has been given two distinct meanings. One is asked of God. The other is the name of God, or the name of El. Latter is probably the better rendering. The name Samuel bears witness to God's power and provision in answering prayer. The boy was his answer and the constant reminder of his mercy and grace in answering prayer. So with boy in hand, it was time to go up to the yearly festivities in Shiloh, verse 21. Then Elkanah went up with all his household to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifices and pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, "I will not go up until the child is weaned, and then I'll bring him, that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever." So Elkanah said to her, "Do what seems best to you. Remain until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord confirm his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. Now when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with a 3-year-old bull, and they offered their sacrifices, and she says what she says to Eli. I suspect that for many people, it'd be an easy thing to rationalize your way out of keeping that vow. Right? The emotional distress brought on by Peninnah, the state of the temple under Eli and his two ungodly sons, her prolonged desire for children. She might have easily shared those things with her husband Elkanah with the hopes that he would nullify her vow. Numbers chapter 30 verses 6 through 15 indicates that a husband could revoke the vow of his wife if he chose to do so. But none of those things deterred her. She was committed to keeping her vow because she was committed to honoring God in doing so. Psalm 15, verse 4 says, "The godly person swears to his or her own hurt and does not change." The preacher of Ecclesiastes advised in chapter 5, verse 4, "When you make a vow, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you owe. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay." Proverbs 20, verse 5 says, "It is a snare for a man to say rashly, 'It is holy,' and after the vows to make inquiry." In other words, to try to get out of it. Better to not make it in the first place. But that was not Hannah. Both she and her husband were committed to keeping their vows. And he was committed to honoring hers. And she had been committed from the beginning. Note again the end of verse 11. "Then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head." She was fully informed when she made that commitment. It wasn't a rash decision. It was her desire to give back to the Lord what he would give to her. And she was fully committed to it. Verse 22, "I will bring him that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever." But she would wait until the boy was weaned. Ancient Near Eastern culture, and even in some cultures today, weaning takes place at much later time than it does here in the West. At this particular time, it was usually around 2 or 3 years of age, but could be a little longer. Can't remember where we were, but one time Laura and I were, I think, overseas somewhere, and we were in a park, and there was a bunch of people around, and there was a lady sitting on a park bench, and her little toddler, must have been about 4 or 5 years old, came up to her and said, "Mommy, Mommy, I'm hungry." And she just undid herself on the park bench, and the little boy, standing fully erect, just started eating. We were like, "Wait a minute, this is not the right picture." But such was her culture. Literal translation of the word weaned is fully dealt with, and some suggest that it includes more than just getting the kid to eat solid foods, but also included spiritual training as well. That could be the case. The point here is that she wasn't trying to prolong the dedication of her request. She was merely wanting to take care of his needs and prepare him for the service that he would do for the rest of his life. And so Elkanah said to her, "Do what seems best to you. Remain until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord confirm his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son until she had weaned him. Now when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, offered the bull and the ephah flour and a jug of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, although the child was young. And then they slaughtered the bull and brought the boy to Eli. And she said, "Oh my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying for this boy. I prayed and to the Lord, and the Lord has given me my petition, which I asked of him. So I have also dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. Notice the stress on prayer in her words. Literal rendering of verses 27 and 28 would be this: "The Lord has granted me my petition, which I petitioned him. Therefore, I have petitioned him," also rendered "lent him. Therefore, I have petitioned him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is petitioned to the Lord." What a commitment here. There's no holding back on Hannah's part. Samuel was what she asked God for, and she was committed to God in the very same breath, verse 11. And here she is reminding Eli of the moment and the answer and committing him to the Lord's care and to his service. Again, beloved, that is a great example of faithfulness. She was committed to her God and to honoring him in the dedication of her son, in the keeping of her vow. As Payne reminds us, God had given him, Hannah gave him back, and Samuel's very name was a reminder of these things. And we should not overlook the sacrifice made by Hannah. But her loss was to be Israel's gain, and she felt amply compensated. It was a loss to Hannah. It would have been for any mother. But it would have been a far greater loss for her to renege on her commitment, both for Israel and for herself. Because the dedication of Samuel was the embodiment of her godliness. She was a God-centered woman, and she was committed to her God and to honoring him in this way. Great, great picture of faithfulness there. Now, next week, we'll look at Hannah's praise in chapter 2. Take a break from our study of Revelation and finish this up, but we want to just quickly look at the third characteristic of a godly mother. Skip down to chapter 2, verse 18. Hannah was a woman of faith. She prayed. Hannah was a woman of faithfulness. She kept the Lord first in her life by keeping her word. And finally, Hannah was a woman of family. She was dedicated to meeting the needs of her family. Chapter 2, verse 18. Now Samuel was ministering before the Lord as a boy wearing a linen ephod. And his mother would make a little robe and bring it to him from year to year, and she would come up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord give you children from this woman in place of the one she dedicated to the Lord." And they went to their own home, and the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to 3 sons and 2 daughters, and the boy Samuel grew before the Lord. Linen ephod was the garment of a priest. It was a closely fit, sleeveless vest covering the torso to the hips. Little robe was an outer garment worn over the ephod. Hannah made him one every year. It was the expression of her motherly love and care for him. don't know if you noticed, but this was the example of the excellent wife of Proverbs 31, right? She makes her garments and she clothes her family. This was Hannah. Despite being dedicated to her God, she was dedicated to her son also, to her family. Her family was still a priority. And so in response, God blessed her with more children. Then Eli would bless Elkanah, his wife, and say, "May the Lord give you children from this woman in the place of the one she dedicated to the Lord." And they went to their own home, and the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to 3 sons and 2 daughters, and the boy Samuel grew before the Lord. Hannah's devotion here is, her devotion to God is the result of is, it results here in great blessing. Notice not only did her family grow, right, but she got to see Samuel grow before the Lord. God's favor was upon him. Beloved, don't ever underestimate the power of a godly life. Right? Even a little insignificant barren woman in the hill country of Ephraim can have a huge impact on a nation, on a people. Be devoted to your God. And be devoted to your family. Be a woman of faith, mothers, and faithfulness, and family. And just see what God will do. Right? God is no man's debtor. Obedience always results in great rewards. Always. Even if we can't see it in the immediate sense. Well, this was Hannah, a woman of faith, a woman of faithfulness, and a woman dedicated to her family. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for Hannah and her incredible life and example of godly living. Lord, help us all to learn from her example, to be men and women of faith who express it in honest, bold prayer, to be men and women of faithfulness who are committed to you and honoring you in all that we say and do. And Lord, that we might be committed to our families as well. Lord, seeking to honor you there first. Seeking to have our impact there first. That we might see a generation raised up to further thy kingdom. Oh Lord, help us to be faithful in these things, leaving all the results to you, we pray. Amen.